Hi, I am here with my girlfriend, Daya Miller. She is a prison wife. I met Daya. Am I butchering your name, honey?
Yes.
What's your name?
No, it's Daya. You're saying it.
Oh, Daya, okay. Yeah, so we met about how many years ago? Yes, and we were in a prison wife group together, and we actually kind of left the group and whatnot, but we remained friends. So I am going to interview her today and just give it, you know, a different spin, just what it feels like, you know what I mean, dating or being married to someone that is incarcerated. So, Daya, first of all, hello. if you could just tell us, I guess your husband, how long you guys have been together, please.
We've been together 6.5 years. We've known each other for 17 years. Never would have thought he would have been my husband, even anybody that I would have dealt with. He came into my life at a vulnerable time where I was trying to find myself. I was done and over dealing with men on the streets. Mm-hmm. He needed something. I needed something. And me and him kind of just touched bases. I checked on him to see how he was. And it just kind of went from there because he had caught me in a vulnerable place. I end up just kind of loving him for him, not for his presence.
Ooh, I never even thought of it like that. Let me ask you this. How do you deal with the people, you know, when you explain that you're married to someone that's incarcerated and stuff? You know, what? How do you deal with that?
Well, today it's a different response than it would have been five or six years ago. 5 or 6 years ago, like I said, me and him was on a spiritual love. I loved him for just him. Mm. It wasn't his presence. So me explaining that to the next person, they couldn't even understand it. Mm. That, you know, that's the type of love like are dealing with that the normal person would not deal with. The world has, you know, gave up on them, you know, but me and him talking at a time where I was trying to get right with myself, trying to get right with God, I felt like he was almost like a heaven sent. Mm. So it was easy to deal with him, but it was difficult to explain to people because they wasn't on that level. Nobody would have never went 5 or 6 years being celibate. I was celibate a year before I even dealt with him.
Oh, same with me, honey.
I'm thinking, okay, this must be God saying, leave these people alone, focus on me, deal with him, love him, bring him closer to me. So it was good. It was good at first, but the intimacy part that we're missing, that the walls are and the guards and the law and the time, all that separates from with us, that's the hard part of it. 6 years down the line. 2 years, when it was a year or two in it, it was a spiritual thing.
Yes.
It was just, I love him. This, you know, me and him, it was me, him, and God, that we're going to do this. I got your back. You got my best. And it wasn't a physical thing. So, yeah. I don't think people still understand it. It's something that only a person going through it would understand. It's because you can't, everybody's story is so different when it comes
Absolutely.
To why. And how do you explain? Because some people just don't explain. They shut it down like, you know, don't ask me. And that's the easy way to kind of deal with it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I got that a lot, you know, especially like when I went to parole for Bobby and, you know, the interviewer, he's, you know, sitting there looking at me, you know, an intelligent woman, you know, I'm beautiful, black woman. You understand what I'm saying? And then he made, you know, it was almost offensive to me because he made it more about me than he did it, you know, than he did about him. You know, he was asking my daughter, you know, how do you feel having a stepfather that's only 11 years older? You know, he kind of crossed the line. And then they look, you know, for women that, you know, because I certainly don't suffer from low self-esteem. And that's one of the things that they think, you know, that, oh, she's desperate.
It's a desperate move.
Absolutely. And it's not. I know for me, the intimacy is just, you know, being able to politic, being able to, you know, talk without, you know, the sex. You understand what? You know, say the physical sex, because there was certainly sex, but you understand what I'm saying? Like, you know, they you know, just being able to get to know that person, you know, their fears and all this bunch of stuff. And then, you know, I know a lot of people are like, yeah, you know, well, they gain their freedom and then they leave you. But these men are showing you who they are. Some of them, you understand what I'm saying? I mean, like, it's not a surprise. I mean, I think a lot of women just choose to ignore that and stuff. But you, I mean, you can kind of sift through the bullshit. You understand what I'm saying? So.
Different type of women that get involved in that.
Yeah.
You have woman that's there to build the man up. You have a woman that's there that wants some love, some different type of love, because no, I don't need your money. I can buy my own stuff.
Exactly.
No, I don't need you to do this. So we be on a whole nother level, but then you have those women, like you say, with that low self-esteem, that, you know, they just want it. They come in there and they're willing to do anything. What you need, I'll bring it in.
Mm-hmm.
How much this month, oh, okay, I'm not going to pay this. I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
I can't do it. I tell my husband all the time, me and you are spiritually married more than anything else. And he thinks in a traditional mind state as far as how I should do things. And I'm like, dude, you're not here. You know,
yeah.
I know you want it to be that way, but you're not here. But
yeah.
It's a perception of how they look at us. And how we sometimes look at them. So some of us put these men on too high of a pedestal.
Girl, bye. I know.
So high where we saw we have lowered ourselves to the point where we lost all ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah, I certainly know that. I mean, that was definitely, you know, something I don't even know how. And not that I have regrets or anything like that.
Oh, no.
But
exactly.
I don't know, you understand, I don't know where I was at that point in my life. And guys, I too was married to someone. I actually got my divorce today, but, you know, that was incarcerated and stuff. And this is not us saying, you know, don't do it, because, I'm certainly not turned off from it. You know, I love someone very much that is incarcerated.
You know what, Sarah? Uh-huh. People that I think that every woman should experience.
Oh, yes.
Even if it's short term, because you really find out your own self-worth. You be like, you know what? Because when I got into the relationship with my husband, I felt like I was worth more than I shouldn't have to be laying up with nobody. I shouldn't have to be accepting just a date here and there. I shouldn't have to do this. Let me get somebody that needs me as much as I need him.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to connect. But it's just we put ourselves so low to accommodate their suffering, and we suffer ourselves.
I agree. Now that I do agree with. I feel like sometimes, you know, they can be selfish when it comes to, you know, I think sometimes we have a tendency to make it look easy. You understand what I'm saying? What we do out here. And it's not, you know, I know me, you know, I didn't necessarily want to add, you understand, to the stress and stuff. So if I went through something, I kind of like just went through it. You understand what I'm saying? I didn't really share everything. You know, that I had to go through, but I know that the deal breaker for me was when my son was murdered, when Joshua was murdered. And, you know, my ex, I can say ex now, but my ex, you know, he wasn't sympathetic, to the fact that my, you know, my ex-husband, you know, helped to pay for my son's funeral. And who plans to bury their 30-year-old? You understand what I'm saying? And, you know, just the sacrifices that I made for him. I mean, he actually didn't call me, you know, he hung up the phone on me. He didn't call me for the funeral. My son died around Christmas. So he didn't call me for the funeral. He didn't call me Christmas. He didn't call me New Year's. You know, I had to go through all of that. And I remember sitting in the funeral. You understand what I'm saying? And instead of focusing on my son, I was, you know, more hurt that, you know, this is somebody that said that he would love me for the rest of my life. You understand what I'm saying? Absolutely. I had forsaken all others for him. You understand what I'm saying? And when I needed that emotional support, because that's all you can give me at this point. You understand what I'm saying? Is that emotional support. And when he took that away, I'm telling you, something snapped and something came unhinged and something died inside of me. You understand what I'm saying? And I am to a point where no one will ever, ever, ever get me there again. You understand what I'm saying? I'm not saying that I can't love you. I can't be in love with you. But as far as becoming discombobulated, if things don't work out, oh, absolutely. Never again.
Yeah.
No, ma'am. Never, ever, 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 ever again. And I'm not bitter. I wish him the best.
Oh.
You understand? I
wish everyone the best. That's what I said. Whatever. And I told my husband, if me and him didn't work out, because we're having our issues now, and I told him, if we don't work out, I still want to be your friend.
Absolutely.
I still want to stay time served. I still want to see you come out those gates, because I know you are innocent from what the law has put on you.
Yeah.
I still want that for you. But he's so bitter. He's like, oh, no, why would we do that? And that's when I have to sit back and be like, wait. Okay, Daria, is this really what you're worth? Do you think that that's good enough?
Yeah.
And just like you say, it's those little things. They can't do anything for us.
Yeah.
But to be there when we really need it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I love my brother, and all he can say is, I wish I was there. I wish I was there to hold you. I wish I was there. He has no way to send me no flowers. He has hardly no words to say. He can't hold me. He can't. And I have to be that woman and that person that say, you know, this is my husband. I'm going to deal with this alone. We deal with everything on our own.
Absolutely.
We just figured out how to not look like a fool to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And deal with them and deal with our bills. And maybe be short on bills to make sure they okay.
Mm-hmm.
Or make sure we get to that visit because they really need that visit. And that's all good and dandy. Like, I don't knock nobody either. I love my husband. But then sometimes I have my days where I say, okay, well, you got to love you too.
Absolutely. And then you think and you wonder, you understand what I'm saying, if the shoe were on the other foot. Because they said the loneliest visiting rooms are those of the women. You understand what I'm saying? Like, it's never crowded. You know, you rarely ever, you know, see a man up there visiting their wife, their girlfriend. You understand what I'm saying? Like, you know.
Your brother's not even going to go around to that prison.
Absolutely.
Like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And you know what? My husband straight out told me one time, if the shoe was on the other foot, absolutely I would be there. Absolutely I would be celibate. Are you kidding me?
Oh.
I couldn't believe that. I couldn't believe it. And see, that's where I had to, you know, shut one eye on him and look at him in another, you know, way. Because I said, wait, hold up. You're lying. You're just lying to yourself. There's no way impossible. A man can't do what a woman can do.
Yeah.
And a woman can't do what a man can do.
Absolutely.
You couldn't do it. You couldn't rock it like me.
Absolutely. I agree. And then, so let me ask you this. How did you deal with, I feel like the women in these relationships, I feel that we deal with, to a certain degree, like post-traumatic stress disorder. Because I know, like, if I don't get a phone call, especially when you're used to getting those phone calls every day, like at nighttime, soon as that phone hangs up, I have a fresh set of stress. wondering, you know what I mean? Not if he's going to call, but, you know, if, God forbid, if he doesn't call, you understand what I'm saying? Are they on lockdown? Yeah. You know, did they get killed during the night? Yeah. You understand what I'm saying? Like, it's so stressful. How did you counter that? How did you deal with that?
You know what? That worry always sits in first. Because you're always like, I hope they didn't get in trouble. I hope did not happen. You know, you're trying to call people. You're calling these prisons. Are you calling people you know that might deal with the same prison? Okay, did you talk to your man? Did you get, you know, it's just an anxiety that comes over you.
Oh, yeah.
It makes you really, really nervous.
Yeah.
And it puts you in that prison state of life. Because we sit up and we sit in the house, just like they do. We sit in the house waiting on a phone ring.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, we waiting by the mailbox.
Oh, yes.
We waiting on the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
We just sit there, we're waiting.
Waiting, absolutely. Absolutely.
And he don't want to call for 2 weeks. Oh, okay. So I'm nervous for 2 weeks, and you just have the attitude. Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's hard, and you always, especially when you're a wife, or you know, you made this promise to each other under God, and you know, and you want to kind of honor that whole platform. You really try to.
Mm-hmm.
Situation makes it very hard.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So how about intimacy throughout this? You guys have been together for 7 years?
Almost.
Okay. So how did you deal with the intimacy part?
The intimacy part, the celibacy kicked in when we before I got with him. So I was celibate prior to him coming in. So I already had a strong line frame, but now we're to the point where we can have these visits and we haven't had them, and now I'm frustrated.
The whole
control that I had when I knew that we couldn't have that conjugal visit, couldn't have that intimate time with each other, it wasn't a problem to me. But now that I know we can and I haven't, I'm frustrated, I'm angry, I'm kind of over the whole situation, because now I feel like, okay, we did the mind thing, meeting other minds. We did that. Okay, we didn't touch on each other hard, and we love each other. Okay, you build me up here, and I build you up there. That's good. But okay, so what about us touching each other? I tell people all the time, I've been married to my husband almost 5 years, with him 6.5 years. I still haven't been able to hold his hand no longer than 30 seconds.
Oh, wow.
And that's it.
Wow. Well, I say, oh, wow, like I was able to, you know what I'm saying?
Right?
But when you put it into that perspective, like, wow. Yeah.
You know, at first you be such in la-la land, you know, when you first get into it, you in la-la land, it don't matter, you just want to be in their presence. But when it starts to get old, and the arguing, and the, you know, life happens, because they have their life, their world, that we have no control over, we're not in it, you know, we just got to sit back and let their world be a world. And then we're in ours.
Absolutely.
We're trying to balance both, but they only have to balance theirs. And they don't understand that part. And you just need that intimate time. Let me cry on your shoulder. You can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
California State Prison, don't you put your head on their shoulder in that visiting room.
Absolutely.
So the whole intimacy part is—it's getting to be a bit rough.
Mm-hmm.
6.5 years down the line, it's starting to be a big challenge.
Yeah.
In my marriage.
Well, I thank God for creativity. Thank God for an overactive imagination, huh?
And imagination.
Exactly. Remember the year? Well, you guys don't know, but we did a secret Valentine in our group and whatnot. And yeah, that was an interesting year. I kind of blessed everybody. But yeah, that was amazing. I'm trying to tell you, that was awesome. But you know, I don't regret. I honestly, like they said, you know, people come in for a lesson or a blessing. You understand what I'm saying? I would never try to assassinate his character or anything like that. I think that he probably, I won't say he gave me the best that he was able to give me, because he certainly could have been better. But, you know, it wasn't all bad. You know, he always made me feel like the most beautiful person in the world. I mean, he really did. I don't care how mad we got. One thing he never called me was a fat bitch or ugly. You understand what I'm saying? So I appreciated that. And I mean, we had some knockdown, drag out stuff. And, you know, even, you know, with the relationship that I'm in now, you understand what I'm saying? I am, I'm not better. But yeah, I just,
yeah, you know, but the challenge with us as women, either staying in that position or coming out of it, is not becoming bitter.
Yeah.
Because when you become bitter and you shut down what God has for you.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, one thing I have figured out, God did not put me in this for me to be so frustrated, for me to be so, you know, to lack, to do this and that. So we have to maintain some balance. And like you said, I have no regrets.
Yeah.
I have no regrets.
Absolutely.
That man has taught me so much about myself.
Yes, absolutely.
And what, like I said, what I'm worth and what I want. And I want him to be a part of it. God will. You know, if it happens, it happens. And if not, I still want the best for him. You know, because there's no regrets. I love him, and I know his potential, and I know his innocence. And, you know, God don't, in the Bible, he says, don't forget about those. You know, and personally, it's just, so some women are just placed, and some people are placed in the world to deal with them. And,
yes,
like, you need to deal with them for a reason, season, or a lifetime. And, you know, you make the best out of it. Don't become bitter in it, because you're going to lose yourself. And
absolutely.
When you get out of it, you're not going to want to love nobody anymore. And no. You know, it's just, you be so uptight with life, so you feel so angry about what you have given into something that didn't get anything back.
Absolutely. So what do you say to those sisters, or how does it feel, you know, when we see our sisters, you know, those that did make the cut, you know, when their husbands, you know, come home and they're just a tyrant, and you know, we're thinking about, I mean, because it's so weird, and it's certainly not funny, but, you know, to see the women... And those men are like tyrants. They're driving them crazy, because I know I've seen, you know, women do the countdown. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Oh, it's 30 days to my baby, 15 days to
and
my baby.
It's sad to say, a lot of women we get into that situation and that marriage and that place in our lives, and when they come home, a lot of them don't work out.
Yeah.
Because I used to tell my husband all the time, and he gets mad. He still gets mad. I tell him, you are in survival mode.
Yeah.
You're not even thinking, because when you was home and we knew each other, we weren't thinking about being those together and all this stuff. Like, I came around at a good sign for him, and he came around at a good sign for me. And it just happened to work out like that. But I was saying, are we going to make it? If you came home tomorrow, like, it's a very small group of women and couples that make it out of that.
Yeah. And why do you think that is, though?
Because of, we both be in a vulnerable place. We both need something, either mind, body, or soul. And they are able to give us something that we need, we're able to give them something we need, so it accommodates each feeling. But then they get old. Once they come home, it's no more about you and her, because you know what, she's really not my type. And you know what, it's not about him. I do love him, but he ain't even been able to get no job. All he do is drink all day and talk mess, and he's so incarcerated and institutionalized, because they go through their stages. All men don't come home and be good. Yeah. They come home in a mess. You know, they come home financially struggling, or they come home with no family support, and it all lands on the woman, and that's too much. Because she's used to dealing with him on the inside, not on the outside.
Yeah.
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 So I think even like when they're getting ready to come out, us women, the ones on the outside, you have to really prepare yourself. Like, they have to go through all kinds of different things to get out. We have to go through all kinds of different things to prepare for them to come home, because we have to know ourselves. If we know we want a man to take care of us, okay, when he come home, he needs to take care of me. You need to have him stable. You need to have him right, you know. And sometimes we put too much expectations on them that they're not going to fulfill, and it doesn't work. Yeah. They end up getting a divorce, or they be married and just kind of do their thing and not be together. But it's sad. But I think it's something it's something that needs to happen. They need somebody to, you know. I feel like it. An inmate that can find some love deserves it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think too that I guess playing the devil's advocate, I think too that you have a lot of them that have been gone, 10, 15, 20 years. You understand what I'm saying? And that's why, I was really surprised my ass got married, to be honest, because I feel like, they should have that year or so, because some of them feel like they're playing catch up. You understand what I'm saying? Like, they haven't, we've had our years of going to the club and hanging out and doing this and doing that. And, some of them, their maturational age, it stops at the time, you understand what I'm saying? The time that they went in there and whatnot. So, they have to play catch up. And whereas, we have, been out here, we've lived our lives and stuff. So. Hold on. Yeah, sorry. I turned over and it ended up hanging the phone. But I was saying that some of them, you understand what I'm saying, they stay stuck at the age. If they went in at 15, some of them, are coming home, 38, 39-year-old, 39, 15-year-olds. You understand what I'm saying? Absolutely. So they want to play catch-up and whatnot. They want to go out there and try to get all the vagina, you understand, that they can get and all this bunch of stuff. And then you have that other, you understand what I'm saying? You have that other, thing that we have to worry about too, because, and I'm not saying a lot of them, but some of them are coming home and they are on the DL. You understand what I'm saying? Like, they've been with men on the inside, and then they come home. I've heard of people having intimacy problems. I've heard of people not being able to get an erection unless you're playing in their backsides. You understand what I'm saying? Yes. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's absolutely crazy. And my thing is this, to each his own. But if that's your bag, stay in it. You understand what I'm saying? Like, don't put a person, at risk because, you want to play both sides.
Yeah.
So.
Happening, and it's sad to say a lot of it do be happening.
Oh,
and
yeah,
you know, and it's sad because you have those people that say, why are you with him? He ain't gonna do nothing but use you, he ain't gonna do nothing but leave you, and we going to back, no, that's not right, and that's exactly what they do,
yeah.
And it's sad, it's a catch 22 with that whole lifestyle.
Well, absolutely. But on the flip side of that, you know what I mean? When people try to, tell me stuff like that, I myself, and I don't know if it's just my arrogance. You understand what I'm saying? But I think that any relationship I want, I can keep. You understand what I'm saying? It's just me wanting to remain in that relationship. You understand? And you have the divorce rate that's out here. I think that there are people, I think it just depends on the person. You understand what I'm saying? I think that there are people that are fully capable of coming out here and being appreciative. You understand what I'm saying? For the sacrifices and stuff. And they get out here and you know, they have great relationships. It's going to take understanding on both parts. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, it really, really, really is. It's going to take understanding on both parts. But I wouldn't trade my experiences for anything in this world, because like you said, it's definitely taught me a lot about myself. It's you know, I've grown, because you know, some of them are so educated. You understand what I'm saying? You know, you can't get a person out here to, you know, to carry a they can't hold their own in a conversation. And, yes. So I love that. It all depends on where you are in life and what you're looking for. Yeah. You understand what I'm saying? And I'm to the point where, you know, even if things don't work out, I'm happy that I could have made, you understand what I'm saying, your stay there, you know, a little easier. You understand what I'm saying? I feel like I definitely got something. I learned a lot from Bobby. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, a lot of things that I can take and go on and move on, you know, in my life. He was very smart. You understand what I'm saying? So, you know, again, I'm not bitter. I feel like I did make, you know, his bit a little bit better. You know, he in some aspects he made my life better. Some, you know, I'd like to kick his fucking teeth in, but you know what I'm saying? So, but you know what I mean? So, but I'm definitely, you know, I'm happy with myself now. You understand what I'm saying? I think that's what was lacking before. You understand what I'm saying? And I've learned to make Sarah happy. I've learned how to be alone and be okay with being alone. You understand what I'm saying? That's why I feel like, you know, I have emerged a healthier, you understand what I'm saying, happier Sarah. And I'm sorry that it took death upon death upon death. It took me being here by myself. You understand what I'm saying? It took, you know, people that I thought would be there for me. You understand what I'm saying? Backing up from me. You understand what I'm saying? So that false sense of security that I had was snatched away. So I had, you know, I was left with myself. You understand what I'm saying? So, yeah, she good now. She's good.
You know what I was sitting up thinking? I used to, before my husband came around, I used to always pray that God used me.
Uh-huh.
And that he make me a vital vessel. And people's lives, and then here this husband come of mine. So you know, I feel like if I don't do nothing else, if me and him don't talk again, if our marriage doesn't work, I really feel like I've done what I'm supposed to do.
Absolutely.
And like, you know, that's for that part where you say, I'm not bitter, I'm happy, I'm in a good place. I know that, you know, it's gonna be all well. It will be well.
Absolutely.
I'm thankful for that, because like I say, I wish you God has exercised patience that I never knew I had.
Absolutely.
Commitment, you know, who would have ever thought? You know, you never would have thought you would have got married in a visitor room.
Absolutely. You know? Shoot, mine was over the phone, so I know.
Okay.
You understand what I'm saying? And I wore my little Kmart ring. I had to purchase my own ring. And I wore that sucker like, you know, it was a 10 carat. You understand what I'm saying? That didn't matter to me. You understand what I'm saying? I just. But listen, I appreciate. So let's just say this. In closing, what would you say, you know, to another woman that's thinking about embarking on this journey? What would be your advice?
I will tell her to gonna be placed higher, and they don't need to be that high.
Wow.
And it's gonna break us down to a point where we should have never been broke down that low. You know, not helping somebody. You shouldn't be broke down that low trying to help somebody and trying to be somebody, you know, shoulder to lean on, and that person they can call a partner. Don't, you shouldn't be so balanced. It's so important. Because you have to. Okay, if you like going to the beach every Saturday, you need to go to the beach. Don't let him come and say, you know what? No, you don't need to wear that. You can't can't do this and you can't know when you're wearing shorts. Why are you wearing shorts? So I'm wearing a bikini because I'm going to the beach. I like going to the beach. That's what makes me happy. I'm going to make you happy, but I got to do what makes me happy too. That balance is so important. And just staying, you know, staying close with God because you know why you're doing what you do. And if you're doing it for any other reason other than to make yourself happy as well, it's a no-go. Run while you can.
Wow. That makes perfect sense. Well, sis, yeah. I appreciate you giving me this impromptu interview. I'm notorious for jumping on the phone. Hey, let's interview. So I appreciate this. I appreciate your honesty. And I thank you so much, for granting us this interview. And you hold on. I'm just going to disconnect here. So thank you for everyone that's listening. Hi, this is Sarah Coleman, and I am back with Michael Lynch. I'm doing part two of the interview. I believe that we left off with Michael's first judge, Paul Weinstein, coming back out of retirement to his post-conviction, Mike. Could you speak up, please, a little bit? And he sounds like this, guys, because we just did an interview and I lost the second part of it. So I'm having to redo the interview again. So I apologize, Mike. Just briefly, if you could tell us again, he showed up at your post-conviction 20 years later, even though he came out of retirement. And who was the judge sitting with?
I don't remember the judge's name that was sitting there, but he came out of retirement. He came back. He was still in retirement. He came back and walked in. The whole tone of my whole post-conviction changed. The judge that was sitting in there kept looking up. The attorney that I had, which at the time was Erica Suda, she was trying to figure out what he was looking at. Me, I was in the blind. She turned around and was like, isn't that your trial attorney? So I'm like,
you mean your trial judge? Man. Your trial judge?
I mean my trial judge. And I said, yeah, it is. He looked around, put his hand on his hips, and went and sat over with the victim. So at the end of it, like I said, it changed the whole tone to my post-conviction hearing and everything. He was in there. The state's attorneys was in there.
You're talking about your state's attorney from your original trial.
Yes.
So
both sitting in there as well.
And who were they sitting with?
They were also sitting with the victim.
So you had Alex Foster, your state's attorney, Deborah Dwyer, your former state's attorney, and Paul Weinstein were all sitting with your victim.
Yes. Now, Deborah Dwyer is also now a judge. She's not a state's attorney anymore. Paul Weinstein, at the end, he got up and said that he just wanted to see what I looked like 20 years later.
Wow. And so, and I understand that Alex Foster is no longer, he's no longer a state's attorney. I believe he's in private practice now, right?
Right.
So tell me again about Paul Weinstein. What did he do with your original trial? I think you had 90 days for something.
Once you get found guilty, during your sentencing, you have 90 days to have a modification of sentence filed. A modification of sentence is used to give you time to be in prison, and after a certain amount of time, you can ask for a modification of sentence where though they're looking to see what you've done since you've been incarcerated or whatever, see if you deserve or warrant your time being reduced. What he did was, once it got put in, 9 months later, well, I was told it was being held in my abeyance, meaning that it was being held secured until such time that I ask. My attorney told me not to ask for it until I served 15 to 20 years. And I had that in writing. And he turned around and denied it 9 months later and never even told me he denied it. And I don't even know why he denied it. So, you know.
So he denied it without you even filing anything.
Exactly. Exactly.
Prematurely. And then also, what else did he do while he was in retirement? You said that you noticed that he was, talk about your days.
Say it one more time.
Talk about your days, your days. You were in, I believe you, go ahead.
I served 2.5 years, out the county jail, out Seven Locks. He refused to give me that time. When we asked for it, every time we asked for it, he just kept denying, just stamping it, denied, and said that he was not crediting me that time. During my post-conviction, that judge said that by law, he cannot deny me that 2.5 years because I've never been locked up as an adult and served no time. So I was not serving time for another crime. The only adult charge I've ever had was a stolen bicycle, and I was given 1 year of unsupervised probation, which I served successfully. But he refused to give me that time. I didn't finally get that time until the post-conviction judge gave me that time. And the look on Weinstein's face, like he was disgusted that he gave me the 2.5 years.
So to catch you guys up to speed with everything that's going on, you know, as a result of this post-conviction, it was denied, right, Mike?
Yes, ma'am.
So that was denied. At his post-conviction, 20 years later, the original prosecutors and the trial judge shows up at his post-conviction with the victim. Michael himself was victimized. He was in Fairbridge Mental Institute or whatever in Rockville. Him and five other boys was raped, sodomized by this Michael Cooker. I'm sorry, Marty Cooker. He was a counselor that was out there and stuff. Martin Cooker was given 40 years. That 40 years was reduced down to 25 years. And of the 25 years, he served 8. He's living out in Virginia now, living his life. He was, Michael's father sued the state of Maryland. He sued the place and whatnot. And we're not even sure because Michael, you know, doesn't know, you know, how much money he was given or anything like that. His father, Rodney Randolph, was a Capitol police officer, Capitol Hill police officer. He sued, he got, we're thinking somewhere in the millions or whatever. His record was sealed because he was a minor. So, Michael's money was not, you know, put in a trust or anything because I think they ruled him incompetent. They said that he wasn't mentally competent enough, you know, to handle his own money. So his father took over his money. The only money that Mike saw out of this, and he didn't see this, was the $30,000 that was given to Barry Helfan to represent him. Everything else his father has kept himself. Lauren Bleeker was his financial attorney or whatever. This is, you know, this was the civil attorney. He sat on Mike's criminal trial, even though this is not, you know, the area of law that, you know, this was not his expertise or whatever. So he sat on there. Michael's father, you know, when he went to court and stuff, Michael's father never pled for his son or anything. In my opinion, he threw this, you know, he threw Michael, you know, under the bus. You understand what I'm saying? So Michael has been in prison for 20 some years. His father has got his money. The trial judge, Paul Weinstein, that's now retired, not only sat on his criminal, he was aware of his civil trial. Everything that I'm saying, I can back up. So he should have recused himself, you know what I'm saying, from the trial. He has taken a personal interest in there. There's a personal vendetta I feel against Michael now. I went down to try to get his record unsealed. Now, Michael was, you know, assaulted. I went to, he's the person that was assaulted. He gave me written permission to go to have that seal taken off. I went down there. I believe Judge Bear is the one that has, you know, that the file is sitting on his desk. Judge Bear's law clerk, even though I had written permission from Mike, came downstairs and told me that they weren't going to let me, you know, have the sealed record and stuff because I needed to have an interested party. And I said, well, how was Michael not an interested party when he was, in fact, the one that was raped? They said, well, he was a minor. He wasn't even, you know, named in the suit. So I went back and I got in touch with Michael's father, who's now in Florida, and, you know, told him that I have something, you know, it's very important. We're not concerned about the money at this point. You know, I need to get into that file, you know, to break that seal or whatever, because they ruled Michael incompetent. I don't know how, you know, just a few years, you know, after that, he's competent. He's not competent enough to handle his money, but he's competent enough, you understand, to stand trial. So he gave me written permission to go back. I went back to the to Montgomery County Courthouse, filed yet another motion to have this seal removed, a motion to reopen that case, with his father's permission. An interested party, the same law clerk from Judge Bear, came back downstairs and told me that they weren't able to do it. And I said, why not now? You guys said I needed an interested party. This is an interested party. You understand what I'm saying? So I feel like with Mike that there's some type of collusion. Even though I went there twice, they didn't deny it on record. You know, I called back to, you know, to look at it because I was going to try to appeal it. And like I said, there's no record of me. They have it in the system, but I'm not able to see it. They showed, you know, they were able to tell me over the phone the times that I came there and stuff. And I said, if there's a denial, how is there an oral, a verbal denial, but there's no denial on paper? There's nothing I can see in the computer. You understand what I'm saying? So then, you know, something just fell in my spirit. I said, okay, if we can't do it this way, let me try to reach out to the victim. I said, you know, I've been raped myself. I've been molested myself. Maybe I can talk to her. You understand what I'm saying? And, you know, try to plead Mike's case or whatever. So I'm looking for her. I went on anywho.com. Found her under the people search. Got a telephone number for her. It was disconnected. So then I said, well, let me go to Facebook. So I put her name in. Nothing came up. But then I looked at the bottom of the page and someone had tagged her in a post 2 years prior. So I clicked on that. It had her name there. But when I clicked on it, her face pops up, but there's an assumed name and whatnot. And then it just fell on my spirit to look at her friends list. On her friends list is the both of the prosecutors, Alex Foster, former prosecutors, Alex Foster and Judge Dwyer. She's talking about in her case, this is 2 years ago, the same time Michael went back to court. She was talking about in her case, I mean, talking about on her page about, you know, wanting to be a social worker or something. And the judge told her that she was very proud of her. You know, let her know she could do anything for her friend. She's calling her a friend. My issue with all of this is, how is it that Mike is going to receive, you know, fair hearings and stuff like that if they have picked a side? You know, they have taken an oath. You understand what I'm saying? To be biased. Well, to not be biased. You know, in these cases and stuff. You understand what I'm saying? So they're not allowed to do this. And on those merits, you know what I'm saying? My thing is this. If they had, you know, that case and whatnot, you know, we're not victim shaming. We're not victim blaming or anything like that. It's horrible what has happened to her. But now, you understand, Michael didn't rape anyone. Michael didn't assault anyone. Michael is guilty for not telling what happened. There's no DNA that was on him. There's no DNA that was on his clothes. There's nothing that connected him there. You know, anything like that. 20 years is enough to not open up your mouth, you understand, and say something and stuff. So with that being said, Mike, how are you feeling about all this?
Well,
you got to speak up.
I'm still very bothered and very hurt for a number of reasons. One, no one is sure on how I actually got found guilty And because of the bias in dealing with this judge, no one was ever made to elect how I got found guilty and if I got found guilty as a conspirator, an aiding and abetting, or as committing an actual crime, because they charged me with attempted rape and they charged me with the actual rape. And I got found guilty on both. I was also charged with first degree assault. Now, the victim even herself said that I never beat her up. I didn't put my hands on her. But I got found guilty for that as well. So don't nobody know exactly on what grounds I got found guilty. Yet alone, he told the jury that they are allowed to make their own assumptions without facts and dealing with my case. My other problem that I had, you know, with it all was, you know, because it feels like this wasn't none of this about a guilty or innocent trial period. And it was more of a race issue because the same situation happened, if I'm not mistaken, it was 2 years later. And every last one of them, it was the same amount of people. Everyone was white, and it was one Chinese guy. And the victim at that time was black. And they beat her and sodomized her with a baseball bat. And no one got nowhere near the type of time that we got. Now, my thing is, like I said, I played a role in it because I should have said something. And I feel very bad about what happened and what transpired that night. I do. And, you know, and I deserve the punishment. Yes, I did. Because I should have said something. I should have helped her, and I didn't. But this case wasn't about a guilty or innocent case. It was a lot more to it all the way around the board. It mainly pertaining to this judge because I never received a fair trial period. When I was sexually abused, he knew of that case. I was a minor, so I never knew that he presided over that civil case or none of that. I didn't find out until recently. But I was always wondering why it was personal with him. But it went from that to a rape case. In his eyes, I was automatically guilty regardless. And he threw a book at me and gave me 3 life sentences. In 25 years, I was wrong, and I've lived with that for decades. I was wrong, but I don't feel like I deserve to spend the rest of my life in prison.
I agree. I said I agree. I don't think you know, I don't think that your involvement you know, yeah, I mean, 20 years, you understand what I'm saying, you know, without minimizing, you know, what the victim has been through and stuff. 20 years for not telling is enough. Is more than enough.
And I mean, yet alone, now as it stands under these new rules and guidelines, they were minors. We all range from 14 to 19. I didn't bring her there. I did not bring her there. I was not one of the ones that met her there. This was not planned. You know, but they are all going home. They are all going home. Even the two that she said beat her up, they are all going home. But because I wasn't a juvenile at the time, I'm left with the burden as if I did everything to her. And I feel bad about what happened to her. But I didn't rape anybody.
Michael, if you had an opportunity, you know, to speak, I'm going to switch it up, to your father. You understand what I'm saying? Knowing his role, knowing, you know, that he didn't fight for you, knowing that you were carted off, you know, to all these different institutions. Oh, and this is the clincher, guys. Michael, the same institution where he was raped, his father left him after he received the money. He left his son there. and whatnot. And he's been to see him two times out of the 20 some years that, you know, he has been incarcerated, and hasn't sent him maybe $1,000. He said total. You understand? So it's like he's living off of, you know, Michael's pain and whatnot. So what would you say, Michael, you know, to your father now? What would the adult Michael say, you know, in hindsight?
I mean, honestly, I wouldn't know what to say, because, you know, it's just to a point now in the way as though the reality of everything, because I don't have nobody on my mother's side of the family, yet alone anybody on his side of the family. I've spent more time incarcerated on this bit, or doing this time alone for these charges than I've been alive. And I've been in mental institutions by my father's hand. By my father's hand. I've been in mental institutions ever since I was maybe 9 or 10 years old, and family issues. And I always thought that he had my best interest. And the fact of the matter is, he didn't. But he was all I had. So everything that I felt like was right, I mean, that came out of his mouth was right. And I was wrong. I mean, I don't know what I would say to him, because, you know, and even though now I'm 39, I still feel a loss. I still feel real lost, because a lot of things I don't understand. But I'm not a bad person. I'm not a bad person. I'm not. You know, and it shows, because it's 20 plus years in of me being in here. I don't even have a fighting ticket. I've graduated. I've done all positive things. But I'm lost because I don't know what to do, you know. And right now at this point, I'm not even sure I even want to ever have a conversation with him again, because of everything that's transpired, because I'm stuck. And you left me here, and you left me here to die in here.
Wow.
And I don't understand how you didn't know that trial judge was also that civil judge, let alone my financial attorney, because he was the one that was doing all the paperwork. But I really feel like he knew.
Yeah.
So I never got a fair trial, period. I never did.
Yeah. And that's the thing, guys. His father has the information that's in that cell. Because, you know, he's sending me, I was asking him for it, and he tried to be funny, and he sent me just his deposition, the father's deposition in the civil trial, as if that would help me. And then he only sent me part of what his attorney was alleging. You know, as far as, you know, this, you know, what scars and stuff Michael was left with and whatnot. So here it is 20 some years later. He says that Hurricane Ike, you know, washed away the, you know, certain portions of the trial. But, you know, he has his deposition, and he has, you know, his attorney. So, I mean, it's sickening to me, because I'm a mother. You understand what I'm saying? And I can't fathom. I can't get my mind to wrap around how a parent, you understand what I'm saying, could choose money over their own child. How they could just leave him, like you said, to die, because they fully intend on Michael dying in prison. I can tell this, you understand what I'm saying, by them showing up to make sure he's not getting any type of rhythm. They're not trying to help me to break the seal. They're not trying to do anything. So they want to, you know, all collude and make this man die in prison. So that is where, I come in at and stuff. I just lost Michael on the line and whatnot, but, yeah, that's where I come in at. And, I will fight, you understand, to right this injustice, because, you know, they should have let the merits of the case just stand on its own. Not, you know, going in and offering any type of self-help and stuff. You understand? Because she told a very compelling story. You know, she was beat and bruised and battered. You understand what I'm saying? Pretty bad and whatnot. Honestly, truth be told, I probably wouldn't have even touched this case. But when you go in and you try to do this, you know, this self-help and stuff, and they start trying to twist and turn the law, you understand what I'm saying? You know, in their favor or whatever, in her favor and whatnot, you understand? Then that to me, it rises to the level of criminal, in my opinion. You understand what I'm saying? Because you can't do that. You understand what I'm saying? He's not being treated fairly either. So, you know, now Michael has become the victim. So that's why I'm here. So I appreciate you guys. I'm listening in, tuning in and whatnot. And I hope that cleared up some things. Now, prayerfully, this time I'll be able to save this. I thank you all for your support. And I would love to hear back from you guys. Maybe if you could go to my page and leave me messages there and whatnot. You know, just how I'm doing. If you guys have a loved one that you'd like me to give an opportunity for them to come and tell their story and stuff. Any way I can be of assistance, you know, if you're a family member of someone that's been incarcerated, by all means, 240-529-3724, 410-733-4526. I would love to talk to you. I would love to, you know, to hear your side. All right. Well, that's enough. You take care. God bless.
The podcast you just heard was published with Anchor. Got something you want to say to the creator of this show? Send them a voice message using the Anchor app, free for iOS and Android.